Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. In today's show, we're going to devote most of our time to Russia's military campaign in Syria to protect the Syrian government and crush ISIS, the militant jihadist movement seeking to take over Syria, Iraq, and other parts of the Muslim world. But let's start with recent significant developments in the war in Afghanistan. And to put these developments in some perspective, I'll briefly recap some Afghan history. In 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan to defend Afghanistan's socialist government, which was under attack by Islamic militants who resented its secular policies. The United States, seeing an opportunity to punish the Soviet Union for its support for Hanoi during the Vietnam War, provided weapons and financial support to the Afghan rebels, known as the Mujahideen, through the Pakistani Secret Service. With U.S. encouragement, Islamists from abroad, including Osama bin Laden, flocked to Afghanistan to join the rebellion. In 1989, the Soviet Union threw in the towel and withdrew its army from Afghanistan. The U.S. also disengaged and played little role in Afghanistan in the aftermath of the country's takeover by the Islamic group, the Taliban. In 2001, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, ostensibly to capture Osama bin Laden, accused by the U.S. of perpetrating the 9/11 attack. However, the fact that Afghanistan was on the route for a proposed natural gas pipeline from the former Soviet Union to Pakistan was also a factor. The U.S. quickly toppled Afghanistan's Taliban government and installed a government allied with the United States. However, 14 years of U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan has failed to quell the Islamist resistance to the U.S.-backed government. Recently, the Islamists captured and briefly held Kunduz, a provincial capital and Afghanistan's fifth-largest city. Marshawn, how significant was the capture of Kunduz by the Taliban?
Well, it was very significant, particularly from a propaganda standpoint, because it was the first time since the fall of the Taliban that the Taliban took control of a major city. However brief that period was, it was significant that the Taliban were able to force out the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police from the city. And the fact that it required possibly U.S. special forces on the ground, but most certainly U.S. air power to help drive the Taliban out of Kunduz was a big propaganda blow for the Afghan government. Because what this demonstrates is Mao's principles of guerrilla warfare. Now, Mao may have been a genocidal despotic tyrant, but he was a brilliant guerrilla commander. If you read his book on guerrilla warfare, one of the things he talks about is the key for an insurgent army is first to establish safe havens outside the enemy's range of attack for the Taliban, that was Pakistan, and then to begin attacking the occupying force in the rural areas. That's the attacks they've been launching ever since really 2001 on U.S. and NATO forces and Afghan National Army in the countryside, gaining control of the countryside and then moving into the cities. The cities are your last target. Once you've isolated the cities, you can then assault them, because assaulting urban areas is notoriously difficult unless you can isolate them. And so from the perspective of the outside world, this does demonstrate that the Taliban now control enough of the countryside to be able to not only launch a full-scale assault, but to successfully take a city. Even if they only held it briefly, they were able to take a city.
So the city was eventually retaken by government forces. One interesting aspect of the capture of Kunduz was the fact that it is so far from the Taliban's base in the rural south of the country. It's quite far to the north.
Well, yes, when you look at the regions of the country that are controlled by the Taliban heartland is in the Pashtun heartland, which is down in Kandahar province in Helmand. That is really been the home base of operations for the Taliban, but not exclusively. They have strong grips in much of Afghanistan right now. There was a recent diagram I saw in the Wall Street Journal, and it demonstrated areas of Afghanistan that were, if not under Taliban control, but were where heavy amounts of attacks were occurring. And these were in areas in Kunduz province, all around Kunduz city, areas around Kabul, areas around all through the south and much of the east of Afghanistan. So we are seeing a resurgent Taliban that is really taking advantage of the vacuum left by U.S. and NATO forces. Because as U.S. and NATO forces have disengaged, so too has the bulk of the firepower possessed by the Afghan National Army. There was actually a great piece I saw on Vice News about the Afghan National Army, and one of the aspects they demonstrated is how the Afghan soldiers were using anti-aircraft guns that had been left there by the Soviets, and this thing was in the back of a flatbed truck. So with the withdrawal of NATO forces, this poorly equipped, poorly led, and very poorly trained Afghan army is now all that really stands between the Taliban and Kabul. And so that's why you're seeing an uptick in attacks, but you're also seeing more of a retreat of the Afghan army and the Afghan police.
Are they losing control of the highways, that is the Afghan government?
From what it appears, at least, they still control the main highway that runs through Afghanistan. But to what extent they actually control it, only really the Afghan army and the Taliban can say, because I'm not actually driving down those roads every day myself. So I couldn't be 100% certain. But it does appear at least that the Afghan National Army is still able to resupply its forces. They're still able to fly troops to where they need to. But the issue is, though, is that while they may control the highways, the Afghan Taliban moves over the mountains. They move through the vast deserts and whatnot. So they don't necessarily need to use the highways to launch these attacks, as has been demonstrated by the attack on Kunduz. So the Afghan army may hold the major cities and they may hold some of the highways, but it is becoming very clear that they are losing more and more control over the countryside with the withdrawal of what really has been the backbone of the Afghan army, which was NATO forces.
President Obama planned to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan before he left office. However, he recently announced that he plans to keep roughly 10,000 U.S. troops there for the foreseeable future. Is a force of this size sufficient to affect the outcome of the war in Afghanistan?
Not realistically. I mean, at this point, what President Obama is doing and what probably successive U.S. presidents will be doing is keep enough troops there to prevent Kabul from falling, I think really is the goal of this. Because as we saw from the offensive in Kunduz, the Afghan army couldn't retake the city by themselves. It required U.S. special forces and it required U.S. airstrikes in order to drive the Taliban out. So 10,000 troops might not sound like a lot, but if they're predominantly special forces and helicopter pilots and A-10 pilots and whatnot, they might be enough to at least hold the government in Kabul in power. But realistically, to defeat the Taliban, no, that's not nearly enough. I mean, the Soviets almost did it, and they had 1 million men in Afghanistan. The only thing that stopped the Soviets from actually completely defeating the Mujahideen was the fact that the United States began supplying the Mujahideen with Stingers. But again, it required an incredible violence of action on the part of the Soviets, massive offensive, indiscriminate bombing, and eventually they were able to wrest parts of the country under their control. But again, the Stinger missile ultimately decided the battle in favor of the Mujahideen. But if you think about it in that context, realistically, 10,000 troops can only put off what is becoming inevitable unless we decide to deploy 1 million men to Afghanistan.
Some reports indicate that there's a rivalry in Afghanistan between the Taliban and the emerging ISIS. What's the difference between the two groups in Afghanistan, and why do they not get along with each other? Don't they have a common objective?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. They have a common ideology, which they share the ideology of militant Wahhabism, which is an extreme branch of Sunni Islam. And they share that in common. But aside from that, politically speaking, the Taliban and ISIS are motivated by two different things. The Taliban is a uniquely Afghan movement. The Afghans hate an invader. If you look at Afghan history, they hate whatever outsider comes in to invade. That's point blank. It doesn't matter whether it's the Mongols, Alexander the Great, the British, the Russians. the Pakistanis, us, it really doesn't matter. They hate invaders and they hate outsiders. The Taliban really doesn't have an ambition to control outside Afghanistan. If anything, the Taliban is what you would call a tribal army. It is the army and the political ideology of the Pashtun people. That really is what the Taliban is. On the other hand, ISIS has a goal to create a global caliphate, a global Islamic state that would span the entire Muslim world and potentially the Western world would be their ultimate goal. And in that sense, the Afghans, they say, are independent from each other, but they're most importantly independent from outsiders. And even though the ISIS shares the same basic ideology as the Taliban, they're not Afghans. And so as far as the Taliban are concerned, it's non-Afghans telling Afghans what to do. And so ironically, that ends up putting the Taliban on the same side as the United States in the fight against ISIS, ironically, because the Taliban, they ultimately answer to Pashtun Wali, to the Pashtun honor code, and to the Pashtun identity, and to the Afghan concept of independence from all outsiders. Now, that doesn't mean the Taliban are better than ISIS. The Taliban are just as bad. But the fundamental reason why they don't like each other is because the Taliban are an Afghan Pashtun movement. ISIS is seen as an Arab outside movement. So basically, the Afghans and the Taliban in particular view ISIS as a foreign army coming in to occupy them. So ironically, that puts them at odds with the Taliban.
Now, let's say that the Taliban is victorious and retakes power in Afghanistan. Will that leave a power vacuum as far as foreign countries go? Will the Chinese, will the Russians attempt to move into this to fill the place of the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly, and again, this goes also in keeping with the fact that the Taliban is a Pashtun predominantly movement. Even if they take Kabul, they probably won't control the entire country. I mean, we saw that from during the 1990s after the fall of the government of Dr. Najibullah. Dr. Mohammad Najibullah was the last communist leader of Afghanistan. And after he was killed and Kabul fell, the first thing all these different Mujahideen entities did was turn their guns on each other. And then what you see in a period of civil war, Taliban take Kabul, but they don't take the whole of the country because the north of Afghanistan is not Pashtun. They are Tajiks and they are Uzbeks. And you have a plethora of other ethnic groups, but really those two are probably the most powerful anti-Taliban force. So on the one hand, the Taliban may take Kabul, but they may not take the entirety of the country, which would leave a power vacuum because while they've taken Kabul and NATO and the U.S. have withdrawn, they're still fighting what may be the remnants of the Northern Alliance, in which case then it would leave them open to receiving arms from somebody, whether it's the Chinese or whether it's the Russians or potentially anyone that they feel could help them in their fight against the Uzbeks and the Tajiks.
And of course, the Russians that historically have tried to move south, and they were opposed by the British in the 19th century. The British fought several wars in Afghanistan to make sure the Russians didn't get there.
Exactly. And so the Russians may try to exert some influence. Again, the Taliban will have an innate distrust of the Russians. So for the Russians to exert influence, it might be difficult. But if the Taliban find themselves in a hard position between the former Afghan government and the Uzbeks and the Tajiks, they may be willing to accept arms from the Russians in order to subdue the north of Afghanistan. So, I mean, it is entirely possible, but definitely the Chinese want to exert influence there as well. So you will see a power vacuum, and you will, as has happened before in Afghan history, somebody else is going to try in to come in and fill the boots of the previous occupier of Afghanistan.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the recent developments in the war in Afghanistan, in particular the fall of Kunduz and its recapture soon thereafter by the government of Afghanistan, and what portends for the future in that conflict. Now, Marshawn, let's turn our attention to the Russian military campaign in Syria. Again, we'll start with a little background. Syria, which borders Israel, Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, was for centuries part of the Ottoman Empire, a large entity that at its height included not only the Mideast, but also northern Africa and large parts of Eastern Europe. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire was dismantled, and the French gained control of Syria as a spoil of war. Following the departure of the French in the 1940s, Syria became an independent republic, which for the past several decades has been headed by the Assad family. Although the government is authoritarian, the Assads have been tolerant of Syria's diverse ethnic and religious minorities, including Christians. General Wesley Clark, a former NATO commander, reported that shortly after 9/11, he saw a U.S. Defense Department document which included Syria on a list of 7 countries in the region that the U.S. planned to take over. Others included Iraq, invaded by the U.S. in 2003, Libya, and Iran, with which the U.S. has long been hostile. Although Syria is not rich in oil like the other three, it is a strategic ally of both Russia and Iran, and provides the Russian Navy with its only Mediterranean port at Tartus. Efforts to overthrow the Syrian government began rather quietly under President Bush the Younger, with financial support for opposition groups in Syria. The effort was stepped up in 2010 when U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford began meeting openly with Syrian opposition groups. Later that year, Debka, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, reported that U.S. allies were bringing jihadist fighters from Libya to the Turkish-Syrian border. Soon thereafter, these foreign jihadists, together with Syrian fighters also sponsored by the U.S., conducted an armed uprising that wreaked havoc throughout Syria, killing about 250,000 people and creating 4 million refugees. The jihadists were supposed to help pave the way for Syria to be taken over by a new U.S.-sponsored Syrian government in exile. However, this plan failed as the jihadists, now ISIS, took the lead in the fighting with their own radical, anti-Western, anti-Christian, and anti-Shia agenda. As ISIS gained ground, Russia and Iran, both threatened by Sunni extremists, stepped up their military support for the Syrian government. And in early October, Russia announced it would deploy ground forces to Syria as part of its escalation. Marchand, could you please describe the nature and the effect of the Russian military escalation in the Syrian war?
Absolutely. Well, the nature and effect of the Russian air campaign, particularly at this stage, has probably really been a shock and awe campaign. They have launched approximately, well, it's hard to say, but on a daily basis, it seems in the ballpark of about 30 some odd airstrikes. That's at the highest, they've launched 50 some odd airstrikes in one day. So that is a mind-boggling number of airstrikes on various entities and locations. They're not just hitting ISIS, they're also hitting Syrian Free Army, Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda in Syria, as well as various other anti-Assad armies. But it has been fairly effective from what I've been reading. They've been hitting communications networks, arms depots. They've been knocking out ISIS tank brigades, which, by the way, ISIS has had a large armored contingent. And this is largely due to the fact they've captured a lot of these tanks from the Iraqi army. But the fact that they've been getting knocked out by the Russian Air Force and the fact that these were captured tanks by and large means that ISIS doesn't have the ability to replenish the loss of tanks. And this is giving the Syrian army on the ground the ability to pick up momentum, because what we're also seeing is the deployment of Russian military advisors on the ground, which is greatly increasing the combat effectiveness of the Syrian army, as well as the deployment of Russian attack helicopters and the deployment of anti-tank missiles by the Russians to aid the Syrian army. We're really starting to see a momentum pushing ISIS and pushing the rebels back and cementing not only Assad's hold in power, but Russian influence in the region.
It's interesting that they're attacking all over the country, and the strategy seems to be quite different from the strategy that, for example, the United States used in Iraq, where you had a sustained bombardment for a long period to try to demoralize and destroy the defensive, and then a massive invasion to take over the whole country. The Russians seem to be attacking many different places with the idea of separating the various concentrations of rebels, cutting off their ability to communicate with each other, probing for weaknesses. It seems to be quite a different strategy.
Well, this is in keeping generally with the Russian military strategy. When you look at, for example, U.S. military strategy in World War II, and the invasion of Iraq closely mimics this, our goal in World War II was drive to Berlin, get to Berlin, get to Berlin. And in Iraq, in the 2003 war, our goal was drive to Baghdad, drive straight up to Baghdad. The Iraqi army largely disappeared, with the exception of the Republican Guard and maybe the Fedayeen, who kept on fighting. What you saw was a direct drive to Baghdad, whereas the Russian model of warfare is total war. It is destruction. You isolate your enemies forces. You separate them from each other, you surround them, and you pulverize them one at a time. Or you pulverize them simultaneously, depending on how your own forces are allocated. But we see that they did this with the Germans on the Eastern Front during World War II. They cut off Paulus's army in Stalingrad, and then as they advanced across into Ukraine, into Belarus, at various other engagements, what the Russian army sought to do was separate the different German armies from each other, isolate them in places like what became Kaliningrad, isolate them around Warsaw, isolate them in the south of Ukraine. All of these were efforts to separate, because an army that is united, an army that is in one cohesive force, is very powerful. But when an army is split up, when its forces are broken down, it is much easier to destroy. So this is in keeping with traditional Russian military strategy of isolate and destroy. And then in the second vein, the heavy, heavy, heavy use of air power is also in keeping with the Russian strategy of warfare. Again, when they attack the idea of the Russian bear, the idea that the Russians use an obscene amount of firepower to take on a much smaller opponent is, again, in keeping with the Russian military strategy. So what we are seeing is the Russian model for an invasion as opposed to the traditional U.S. model, which is just drive to the capital, take the capital, and then we've won. The Russian model is you isolate and destroy the forces. And the ultimate effect of this is that it will lead, potentially, I should say anyway, to the destruction of the Syrian Free Army and the pushing of ISIS out of the country. Because once you've surrounded an entity, once you've either pulverized it to the point that they've surrendered or you've killed everyone in that fighting unit, the fact is you completely eliminated it as a fighting force. So this way, when the conflict is over, you aren't left with an enemy fighting in your rear, as opposed to what happened to the U.S. forces in Iraq, where we were left with a by and large intact Iraqi insurgency in our rear after we had won, because we didn't surround, or we weren't able to surround and pulverize the Iraqi army, because in most cases they surrendered before we got the chance to. But the same principle applies.
Russians are fortunate in that ISIS has no air force. Are these Russian planes being used to bomb, let's say, infrastructure, or are they being used as close air support for advancing infantry troops?
A little bit of both. What you're seeing is that the heavy use of the Su-35 to launch surgical strikes on the ISIS infrastructure, on their command posts, on their communications network. And then what you're also seeing is the use of the Su-24 ground support aircraft to come in and provide close air support to advancing Syrian, Iranian, Hezbollah troops, along with the Russian military advisors and other military advisors potentially. Well, again, it's traditional modern warfare. It sounds a little weird to say traditional modern warfare, but this is the principle of modern warfare, the ability to, on the one hand, launch surgical strikes to knock out your enemy's command and control networks, to hit their ammunition depots and their supply lines, but then at the same time using that close-in air support to support your ground units in any potential offensive.
They are attacking across the country from places like Homs in the south, the suburbs of Damascus, and the Russians are also attacking Aleppo. Could you talk about the importance of the city of Aleppo in northern Syria?
For ISIS and the rebels, the other rebel groups, to gain control of Aleppo is to hold one of the symbolic capitals of Syria. Many of Syria's great leaders came from Aleppo. In fact, Nur ed-Din, who's a very important Islamic historical figure, came from Aleppo. He was the emir of Aleppo, actually. He was a Turk, but he was the emir of Aleppo. So controlling Aleppo is not only to control a population center, it is also to control a symbol. The other factor, too, is that Aleppo is very close to the border with Turkey. So it provides a ready route for Turkey and the NATO to supply the Syrian Free Army.
As we mentioned earlier, the Turkish-Syrian border was the initial staging ground for the rebels sponsored by the U.S. and its allies, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, to enter Syria to begin this rebellion.
What you're seeing in the attacks on the area around Latakia, the suburbs of Damascus, the Homs, Hama, Aleppo, what you're seeing is they're trying to control the urban centers along the western side of Syria. Most of the east is controlled by ISIS, but they if the government can gain control of the west of Syria, the major urban centers, major population centers, they can then push into eastern Syria fairly unimpeded. and ultimately take Raqqa, which I think is their main objective. Raqqa is the de facto ISIS capital. If Raqqa falls, then it is a death blow to ISIS. Hitting all these major cities at once, Latakia, Homs, Hama, the suburbs of Damascus, and Aleppo all at the same time, prevent the rebels and prevent ISIS from shifting their fighting power to one city. Because before, the Syrian army didn't have the ability to hit more than one city at a time. So when they would push the offensive in one area, all of the rebels would divert their fighting power to that one area. And then when the government forces hit another area, the rebels would divert all their fighting power to that area. So this way, it spreads the rebels really thin, while at the same time being able to exploit the divisions between the rebels, the weaknesses. And then, of course, they are coordinating with the Iraqis, because there is a joint command center in Baghdad where the Russians, the Syrians, the Iranians, and the Iraqis are all coordinating operations. So while the Iraqis are pushing ISIS in Iraq, the Syrians and the Russians are able to push them, and along with the Iranians, are able to push them in Syria. So ISIS is now finding itself fighting a two-front war, and this is just how the Russians like it. The Russians like their enemy divided, spread thin, so then they can punch holes in them. And because, again, that is the same strategy they used during World War II, when they exploited the fact that the Germans, the Normandy landings, which were coordinated with the Soviets exploited the fact that the German forces were being drawn to go fight the Allied invasion in Normandy, while at the same time the Russians could push a weakened German force on the Eastern Front. It's the same kind of strategy.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm talking with Marshad McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, about the Russian offensive in Syria. Now, Marshad, you just mentioned the Russian establishment of this joint information center in Baghdad. This is a huge diplomatic coup for the Russians, since we, of course, invaded Iraq in 2003 and occupied it for many years. Does this signal a shift on the part of the Iraqis towards Russia?
Absolutely. I mean, it is very embarrassing for the United States, because this could have been a role that the United States played. The Iraqis are turning to the Russians because they view the United States as indecisive, as weak, and unable to actually flex its muscle. You know, the United States appears, militarily speaking, impotent, because we have not even been able to stem the flow of ISIS. We kind of slowed it a little bit, but we haven't stopped it in its tracks. Whereas on the other hand, the Russians are coming in with a tremendous amount of firepower. That they're bringing in troops. They're not only bringing in their own troops and their own aircraft, they're bringing in Iranians, they're bringing in Hezbollah, they're bringing in Cubans. So they appear decisive and strong, and they're winning victories. The United States is not winning victories on the ground. Russia is. And so what this is demonstrating to the Iraqis is that if you want to bet on a winning horse, Russia's the horse you bet on. You want to bet on the guy who looks like they're going to win the war, you bet on the Russians. And so we are seeing a shift towards Russia, and it's not a totally irrational thing from the perspective of the Iraqis, because really democracy, dictatorship, what they care about is who's going to win the war. And right now, it certainly looks like the Russians are the ones who are able to take cities and hold cities, take ground and hold ground, and are able to push ISIS and the rebels back. And there certainly is a growing domestic popularity, because I was reading articles in the Associated Press and Reuters about how Iraqis were holding up portraits of Vladimir Putin, and how there was an artist in Baghdad who's unemployed, and he's painting to make a living for his family. And he says, what people want are paintings of Putin. They could be doing paintings of Obama, but we'd have to be winning the war on the ground for that. And sad though it is to say, the Russians are the ones who are winning. So that's why we're seeing this massive political change in Iraq, and this massive domestic opinion change in Iraq to Russia away from the U.S.
Marshawn, in our September show, we talked about the initial Russian buildup in Syria. You reviewed some of the important military technology that Russia was bringing to Syria, including the S-24 and S-25 aircraft, the M-24 ground attack transport helicopter, and the Coronet anti-tank missile. Early in this campaign, Russia launched cruise missiles from warships in the Caspian Sea. Now, these missiles traveled over 900 miles to hit multiple targets in Syria. What does this say about Russian missile technology?
These cruise missiles weren't a necessary effort. but it was a statement. They were launched over 900 miles from the Caspian Sea to strike targets across Syria. So it was meant to demonstrate Russian military capabilities and to demonstrate that they had newer and better cruise missile technology than they had before. It was to demonstrate that this isn't the dilapidated army of Yeltsin's Russia, that it is a new Russia. Now, it is possible, we have heard reports that some of the cruise missiles crashed, and that's entirely possible, but the fact is that a statement was made, a point was made, which was that their cruise missiles can travel this obscene distance to accurately strike targets over 900 miles away. And that, I think, was the major point of the cruise missiles. And it was also a statement to ISIS, too, because it demonstrated that even if you can push our aircraft away, even if for whatever reason somebody started supplying you with stingers, whether the Saudis, the Qataris, we can still hit you from the Caspian Sea and there's nothing you can do. So it does have a twofold effect because it really demonstrates to ISIS that we can hit you wherever you are and there's nothing you can do about it.
Does it call into question the possible effectiveness of NATO's proposed missile shield in Europe, which ostensibly is to be directed against Iran, but I think the Russians feel that it's directed against them?
Well, especially when you're putting the missiles in Poland, I don't think the Poles are all that worried about getting bombarded by the Iranians. But even for then, it is entirely dependent because any missile defense shield has its vulnerabilities. There is no substitute for tanks and troops on the ground because at the end of the day, there will always be something that can penetrate. And certainly with the investment in cyber warfare that the Russians and the Chinese have, that's something that could impede our missile defense shield. Again, one of the other things that we have to factor in is that the Chinese in particular have been investing very heavily in satellite killer technology, missiles designed to shoot down satellites in addition to suicide satellites, which hurtle around the Earth disguised as communication satellites, but in the event of war can be triggered to slam into our satellites. How well our missile defense shield will work without GPS, I have no idea. And how effective Russian missiles will be in penetrating our missile defense shield, that I don't know. But we do have to understand the fact that the missile defense shield alone is not enough to protect Western Europe from a Russian threat. If that's what we're truly afraid of, then it is definitely not enough.
There was a lot of talk in the United States that we could overthrow Assad with just an air campaign supplemented by surrogates. However, the Russians are fighting ISIS with a lot of troops on the ground, and reports are that Iranians troops and Hezbollah troops from Lebanon are prominent amongst the fighters. Could you talk about their role? Why, for example, is Iran fighting in Syria with the Russians?
Well, Iran's fighting in Syria because Iran is Russia's proxy. I hear a lot of pundits on various news outlets making ridiculous statements like, Assad is Iran's puppet. But that's only one layer of the onion. Assad is Russia's puppet and Iran is Russia's puppet. They are Russia's proxy powers. So Iran has every interest in keeping Assad in power because if it empowers Russia, it empowers Iran. And certainly Iran would rather see a pro-Russian Assad in power that is part of a fringe Shiite sect, but a Shiite sect nonetheless, in power than Wahhabi jihadists who are militantly anti-Shia and anti-Russian, which would further isolate Iran. So Iran has every reason, politically speaking, to want to keep Assad in power. And certainly the Russians have every reason to coax the Iranians into helping to keep the Russians in power. Iran is in no shape or form a weak military power. They are a significant military force trained and supplied by the Russians. Their senior military leadership does have a fair amount of combat experience, and certainly their special forces aided Shiite militias in their fight against the United States in places like Iraq.
March, could you give us a little history on the Iranian special forces?
The Iranian special forces have a history. Their history begins with the Iran-Iraq war and Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran. Now, the war for the Iranians was very catastrophic because they faced really what was a static war. It was trench warfare. It was much more akin to World War I than to World War II. But still, this taught the Iranians very important lessons and really gave their new special forces a sort of trial by fire. After that, we begin to see Iranian special forces pop up in places like Iraq, supporting the insurgency against Saddam Hussein. And then again, later on, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, supporting Shiite militias against the United States. So this did kind of give the Iranians a trial by fire. But that was their foray into more or less conventional war. But we see their development into unconventional war, as I mentioned, with the insurgencies against Saddam, the insurgency against the United States, and Iran's active support for the Shia militia Hezbollah in Lebanon. We saw Iranian support during the Lebanese civil war, during the war with Israel. We see a tremendous involvement by the Iranian special forces in Lebanon. So this really has given the Iranians a tremendous amount of combat experience in fields such as urban warfare, guerrilla warfare, and even conventional warfare against far superior and far more technologically advanced militaries. The Iranian and special forces are not, they're not your sort of typical Middle Eastern special forces. They have a lot of combat experience behind them. And that is kind of very in brief their overall combat history. And then now we see them appearing in very large numbers in Syria fighting against, and in Iraq fighting against ISIS and the Syrian rebels.
Indeed, reports indicate that the lead in the fighting is being undertaken by Iranians and by Hezbollah, with the regular Syrian army acting really as a supplement, as a backup force. Could you also talk about Hezbollah? What's Hezbollah's background? Why is Hezbollah in Syria fighting?
Well, Hezbollah came into existence during the Lebanese civil war as one of the many militias fighting not only the Israelis, but fighting the Falangists, the Christian militias, and again, fighting against other militias in Lebanon. So Hezbollah is born into a civil war. This gave Hezbollah a lot of experience, particularly in the very intense street battles that took place in Beirut during the war. But Hezbollah emerged to prominence particularly after the Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. We saw that really what was the freedom of movement of Hezbollah, because the backbone of Hezbollah's support has been in the Baalbek Valley in southern Lebanon. So once Israel withdrew from Lebanon, we saw a freedom of support for Hezbollah, and Hezbollah really emerged as a prominent political force in the early 2000s in Lebanon. We see after the 2006 Lebanese-Israeli war, the military effectiveness of Hezbollah by the fact that they really damaged the Israeli forces as they attempted to push deeper into southern Lebanon. So Hezbollah is a very potent, not only political force led by Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon, but they are also a potent military force. Their expertise is unconventional warfare, and it is also urban warfare. So they bring a very urban warfare skill, a particular urban warfare skill, to the fighting in Syria, which necessarily the other armies wouldn't possess. They are your more or less urban warfare technicians, if you had to give them a specialty.
Are there Russian soldiers on the ground in Syria? And is it the first time that they've fought with Iranians and Hezbollah?
Well, there are very possibly Russian special forces on the ground. That is hard to confirm because none of them have been captured and dragged through the streets. But as far as we know, it is fair to guess, given the number of Russian special forces in the country, given the number of Spetsnaz on the ground, Spetsnaz Marines, Russian GRU units on the ground, that's Russian military intelligence, it is highly plausible that there are Russian troops engaged in combat on the ground, and that indeed they may be the ones directing the airstrikes. I certainly have to imagine that the Russians aren't simply trusting Syrians to direct their airstrikes. I'm pretty sure it's Russian special forces on the ground. And that would also largely explain the effectiveness of the Russian airstrikes, would be their special forces and their agents operating on the ground. And it would be in keeping with the Russian way of warfare. They don't necessarily tell you, like in eastern Ukraine, that they have special forces on the ground, but we all know they do. And they do have a history of cooperating with the Iranians in places like Lebanon and previously in Syria. So the Russians and the Iranians do have a history together. And certainly the Iranian army has been trained, equipped, and advised by the Russians. I read a statistic many, many years ago that Russians had upwards of 50,000 troops operating inside Iran. So, I mean, this would not be the first foray into Persian Russian relations, military relations.
And taken together with the establishment of this Joint Information Center in Baghdad, it portends a very formidable coalition in the Mideast under Russia, which could threaten U.S. influence in the region.
Absolutely. What we are seeing is the development of interoperability between the Russians, the Iranians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, and potentially the Cubans and the Chinese, because there have been reports that there are Cuban special forces on the ground, and there have been scattered reports that there may be Chinese special forces or Chinese advisors on the ground as well. So this Joint Operations Center, or Joint Information Center, I should say, is helping to build cohesiveness between these fighting units, much in the same sense that there are NATO joint command centers that help coordinate NATO operations. And certainly NATO has trained through its operations in Afghanistan, through its regular exercises in Europe and its operations in Iraq, to work together under one unified command. This now is happening, but on the Russian side of the spectrum.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm speaking with Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the Russian intervention in Syria, and in particular the assistance that Russia is receiving from Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah. And now, Marshawn, you also mentioned the involvement of Cuba. And I should mention that a U.S. official recently confirmed to Fox News that Cuban paramilitary and special forces units are on the ground in Syria. This official said that it appears that the Russians trained these Cubans in Russia and then flew them to Syria to operate Russian tanks. So what does this suggest to you as far as the Cuban contribution?
Well, this is really in keeping with Russian-Cuban history. These Cuban troops, we tend to sort of scoff at the Cubans and we think of, oh, the Cubans, just another Latin American country like, the Mexican army. We, quake in our boots because, the Mexican army is notoriously corrupt and they've had whole parachute companies defect and join the cartels. Cuba is not that case. Cuban special forces have a very long combat history. They deployed to combat operations in Angola some 35,000 Cuban troops fought against the South African army in Angola. And that's important because the South African army is not a third world army, especially during those days, during the days of apartheid. The South African army was a first world army, and the Cubans deployed 35,000 troops to fight them. Che Guevara had fought with the Cubans there. And then
Marshawn, in case the audience is not aware, what was the purpose of the Cuban intervention in Angola? And this took place over a very prolonged period in the 1970s and 80s. I think it only ended in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed.
The Cubans deployed to support the Russians, and the Russians were supporting the MPLA, who were the communists in Angola. There were several factions. You had the MPLA supported by the Russians and the Cubans, and you had UNITA in the south supported by the South Africans. So the Russians were trying to maintain the communist government, which had come to power in the wake of the Portuguese withdrawal from Angola.
And the Cubans seemed to be always ready to intervene in what they saw was anti-colonial war effort in cooperation with the Russians. Sometimes they got a step ahead of the Russians. I believe they sent their troops to Angola originally over Russian objections. We also saw the Cuban troops in action in Grenada in 1983. Grenada in the Caribbean provided the Cubans with an opportunity for military expansion in the region. They invited the Cubans to build an airfield there and establish a permanent military presence. The United States, of course, is very upset. This is during the Cold War with the expansion of Cuba and the Caribbean, which it saw, of course, saw as a surrogate for Russia. And the United States invaded Grenada. How did the Cuban troops perform in the invasion of Grenada and defending against the U.S. troops?
Well, relatively speaking, the Cubans performed surprisingly well. I think certainly U.S. military analysts had underestimated the combat effectiveness of the Cubans, and we certainly received more casualties than we had planned on receiving. Again, we were still able to drive the Cubans out of Grenada, but still, there was a lot more resistance than expected. We took more casualties than expected, and this was the first engagement of Cubans with American forces. So even though the Cubans lost, it did provide important lessons learned for the Cuban army as to their relative effectiveness against the United States forces. And this isn't also the first time that they've come up against U.S. surrogates armed with U.S. equipment. This is the first time they came up against U.S. forces. But in Ethiopia, they fought against the Somalis who invaded, backed by the United States, who invaded Ethiopia. The Cubans had deployed somewhere in the ballpark of between 15,000 and 18,000 Cuban troops, and really proved to be one of the deciding factors in the defeat of the Somalis. And what's important is the Russians backed the Ethiopians, and the United States backed the Somalis, and this definitely had an important effect on the Ethiopians' capabilities, because early on in the war, they faced a major setback with the loss of initial air superiority and with loss of some of their major line fighting units at the hand of the Somalis. So it definitely can be said that the deciding factor on the ground was the Cubans. And then, of course, this also isn't the first time that the Cubans have had troops in Syria. During the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when the Arab states of Syria and Egypt invaded Israel, there were approximately 500 Cuban military advisors on the side of the Syrians. So this isn't the first time that the Cubans have been in Syria either. The Cubans are a very combat experienced and combat effective force, and it's very natural that they would come in to aid their old ally, the Russians.
They're very ideologically driven, the Cubans.
Well, absolutely. And also from the Cuban perspective, and indeed one of the things we're seeing from a global perspective, the Russians are proven allies. If there's anything that the U.S. used to stand for, it was that we stood by our allies through thick and thin. But one of the things that you've seen in the post-Cold War is that our friendship can come and go with the wind. And that's certainly what happened in Iraq. We cannot ensure the survival of any regime because the policies are going to change from president to president and from year to year based on the political situation inside the United States. Whereas the Russians have always been very clear that they stand beside their allies. So if you're a dictator and you want a friend that's going to ensure you're going to stay in power, then you become friends with the Russians. And the Cubans are ideologically much more communist than you could say even the Russians are today. So their old communist ally does play a role. But certainly the Russians are an ally they know that will be there in the end. And the same thing for the Iranians. We can open the door all day long for the Iranians, but the Iranians will still choose Russia over the United States because Russia is a friend that stays loyal. And that's its reputation. And that's why they're going in to support Bashar al-Assad, because they're proving that they are the side you want to bet on. They're the friend you want to have in a bad neighborhood because they're the one that's going to come in and join the fight with you.
Now let's take a moment to talk about the U.S. response, the U.S. options with respect to the Russian intervention in the Syrian war. One of the tactics that the United States had pursued for some years was to train so-called moderate rebel soldiers to carry on the fight against Assad in the hopes that when the combined jihadists and government-sponsored army was successful in overthrowing Assad, ultimately, a pro-American government would be installed. But recently, the United States really gave up on this training effort. So few soldiers were produced, and that the United States is now, it seems, switched to directly supplying a greater amount of weapons to the Syrian rebels. For example, it's increased the supply of TOW missiles. Could you tell us what these TOW TOW missiles are and why they would be useful to the rebels?
Absolutely. The TOW missile is an anti-tank missile. It can be either personnel carried, fired by a two-man crew, or it can be vehicle-mounted, such as mounted on armored vehicles. It's a very effective anti-tank missile, and it's one of the reasons why we've been so reluctant to supply these to the Syrian rebels is much the same way we were reluctant to supply Stingers to the Mujahideen. These same TOW missiles that can knock out Russian tanks can also knock out American tanks. And so there is a tremendous reluctance because we do know U.S. history, and these things could very well be turned against us. But it is a sign of desperation, the fact that we are supplying more and more of these TOW missiles, because it demonstrates that we're losing confidence in the rebels' ability to defeat Bashar al-Assad.
One of the other options that the United States has been discussing is the idea of creating a no-fly zone over Syria. Presumably, it would prevent the Russians from taking to the air as well. Is this a realistic option?
You know what I would like to say is to the eggheads, as it were, on the mainstream media who like to say that, we should just have a no-fly zone, and certainly to some of our presidential candidates, is good luck with that. Because if we say we're implementing a no-fly zone and the Russians fly their jets through and say, what are you going to do about it? Realistically, what are we going to do about it? Are we really going to risk an all-out war with Russia, shooting down Russian jets in order to enforce a no-fly zone? And then, of course, the other thing is that the Russians have been shipping to Bashar al-Assad S-300 surface-to-air missiles, which are capable of hitting our aircraft. So, potentially speaking, if we were to try to enforce a no-fly zone, not only do we run the risk of our aircraft getting in a shooting matches with the Russians, but we also run the risk of our aircraft being shot down by the Syrian army. And so, in which case, we would have to go in on the ground, and go in on the ground against Russians, Iranians, Hezbollah, and Cubans, and potentially Chinese special forces. So this is not a realistic option. It's rhetoric. I know it sounds really great on the television, but the world isn't Call of Duty. It's not. The fact is that we cannot, because of these Russian aircraft, enforce a no-fly zone. It's just not feasible, not unless we're willing to start killing Russians. And I'm not advocating that by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm saying that we do have to be aware that what we're suggesting by implementing a no-fly zone is a potential direct confrontation with the Russians. Because what happens when the Russians tell us no to the no-fly zone? Do we just walk away, or do we try to enforce it? If we try to enforce it, do we shoot down Russian jets? And that's something we need to consider.
You talked about the presidential candidates, the election, and of course the first Democratic debate was held on October 14th, and the no-fly zone was supported by Hillary Clinton. She said it should be on the table, whereas the other Democratic candidates were not very receptive to the idea. On the other hand, the Republican candidates, as you mentioned, seem to be generally in favor of, although Donald Trump had no position on it. One of the quotes that I found interesting was from Senator Lindsey Graham, who said, quote, referring to Vladimir Putin, anybody who rides around on a horse without their shirt, I can handle that guy, end quote. So I'm wondering, does Lindsey Graham, do these candidates really have a good concept of who they're dealing with?
When most of these candidates were just entering politics, Putin was killing people for the KGB. You know, though Putin does present as a kind of cartoonish Soviet-era villain, a James Bond villain in some instances, you know, riding bareback without a shirt on, we do have to realize that he isn't a fool. We do have to realize who we are messing with. This man is former KGB. This man has probably murdered people for the Soviet state. He is not somebody to be trifled with. The worst thing you can do, and I'm not a Putin lover by any stretch of the imagination, but the worst thing you could do is underestimate an enemy. Because every time we've underestimated an enemy, it's gotten us smacked in the mouth. We looked at bin Laden and we thought, oh, he's just a cartoonish villain. And then we lost 3,000 American lives. We did the same thing with the Japanese. We thought there's no way that a small Asian nation like Japan would dare attack the United States. And we nearly lost our whole Pacific fleet. We have to be aware that though there are things about Putin that we might find comical, he is far from a comical individual and somebody we do need to take very seriously. Because like I say, well, Lindsey Graham was in college. Putin was murdering people for the KGB, and he was developing networks of spies, and he was developing networks of illegal arms trafficking, and you know, the whole works. This man is a brutal killer. If we wanted to have somebody who could go toe-to-toe with Putin, we would probably need to nominate a former director of the CIA.
Marshawn, we have to go in a moment, but do you have any final thoughts about how you see the Syrian war developing over the next weeks and months?
I think, and though it's not fashionable right now to say it, I think the most practical thing for us to do at this point would be let the Russians deal with ISIS in Syria. Okay, we can live with Bashar al-Assad right now. We might not like him. Okay, he drops bombs on his own people. Well, Mugabe commits genocide. We're not going to go into every country where some despot rules. On the other hand, what we can do is utilize the Russian offensive in Syria to our advantage. Well, they're pushing the offensive in Syria. Now's our time to push the offensive in Iraq. If we push the offensive in Iraq, we can hit ISIS from not only both sides, but we can also cement our foothold in Iraq. Because if we lose our foothold in Iraq, if we fail to take the initiative, and we continue with this bashing our head into the concrete philosophy of arming ne'er-do-well rebels who are basically Al-Qaeda incorporated, we really run the risk of losing not just Syria, but losing Iraq and losing the whole of the Middle East to the Russians. And that could be disastrous. There's nothing worse than if Vladimir Putin could turn off the tap to our oil overnight.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.